You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2025 Giro d'Italia. Celebrating 10 years of the cycling podcast on the ground, every day at the Giro d'Italia.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, non spigudeci cora. Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci cora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Hello and joining you at the start of the week in which we will set sail for the Giro d'Italia. None of the usual other tenuous asides needed here. My name is Daniel Freeman. I'm the host of this XL preview of La Corsa Rosa, in which we'll tell you where the race is going, who's riding, and also crucially, who will be podcasting with me first in Albania and then the Bel Paese, that is Italy, over the next three and a bit weeks. Joining me today, but alas, not in the cycling podcast Cinquecento. It's not a Cinquecento. I hope it's not a Cinquecento. If anyone at Europe Cars listening, as we make our way around Italy, is Rob Hatch.
Ciao.
Who's not been selected for the actual podcast lineup.
On the bench.
Overlooked this year.
What unlucky. A mission.
Unlucky son. And back, I think, for his fourth year, and one of the lucky individuals will be accompanying me for at least part of the greatest road trip in podcasting. It's Il Barone, Brian Nygaard, who is not in Italy, would ordinarily be in Italy already, but I believe he's in Copenhagen and a very busy man this morning.
That's correct, Daniel, and buonasera to the both of you.
Buonasera. Is it sera already? Half four.
No, it's getting
half,
there. It's getting
yeah,
there.
Half five in the afternoon. Chaps, how are we all doing? How are we looking forward to the Giro?
Can't wait as usual. As you know, I'm obsessed with this race. It is the best in the year. It's the best time in the year. It's the best jersey. It's the best country. It's the best everything. Can't wait.
Yeah, same for me. It's always when the jasmine flowers start to bloom in Italy, it's time for the Giro. It's something happens to me physically, mentally. It's that feeling where you just need to hit the road and start to see bike racing live.
My God, I feel the need to dial down some of this enthusiasm. I've been feeling overwhelmed by you chaps.
I thought you were the real Italophile.
No,
come on.
I'm very much looking forward to it as well. I'm particularly looking forward to the start for reasons we'll find out about in a minute. Chaps, Lionel will not be joining us today, but he will be with us in Albania. And on the subject of absent friends, I also wanted to just say how much Brian and I particularly will very much miss our friends from Bidon Al Vento, who've been ever present at our side in the mix zone over the last few years, but unfortunately won't be at the race this year. So in particular, that's Leonardo Piccione and Filippo Kautz. Chaps, if you're listening, as I said, you will be very much missed. The one fragment of that operation will be in Italy with us. More on him, more on that later. I'd also, of course, like to mention our other good friend and institution of the Giro d'Italia, Gianni Savio, who, of course, we lost in January. Brian, you and I will find a way to pay tribute to Gianni along the way, I'm sure. Now, chaps, a lot to discuss as regards the Giro d'Italia, but a lot has been happening in the world of professional cycling. We're not going to do a fully fledged news roundup or newsette this week, but it would be remiss of us not to mention some of the racing that has been going on. The Tour de Romandie happened at the weekend, and Rob, I can't remember whether you or maybe you, Brian, were on the podcast a few weeks ago when I was decrying João Almeida's lack of, well, his inability to finish off when it came to short stage races and the fact that he let a few opportunities slip. Now, since then, he can't stop winning these races, can he? Because he won the Tour of the Basque Country and he won at Romandie as well, quite comfortably in the end, I suppose. Stage winners were Sam Watson, Matthew Brennan, Lorenzo Fortunato of Astana, more about them in a second, Jay Vine, UAE, Lenny Martinez and Remco Evenepoel. The top three on general classification were Almeida, Lenny Martinez, who finished just 26 seconds down after a very creditable last day time trial defense, I thought, and Jay Vine, 41 seconds down in third. Remco Evenepoel finished fifth. 1 minute and 26 seconds adrift of Joao Almeida. Quite a low-key week for Remco Evenepoel until that final day time trial. But I mentioned Fortunato and Astana. What a week they had. Extraordinary. Someone posted a picture on Twitter earlier of, well, they said, this is Astana this week. And it was a picture of the Astana class of 2009 featuring Alberto Contador, the controversial Lance Armstrong, and so on and so on. Why was their week so good? Well, at the Tour of Turkey, they were first on GC with Wout Poels and Harald Lopez. They got stage wins with Lopez and Poels and Malucelli.
And gone off. They had four stage wins out of the seven.
I forgot the fourth one. And Romandie, as I already mentioned, Fortunato won a stage and was fourth overall. The Lotto Ardennes Classic, first and second with Max Kanter and Case Ball. This all puts them within 200 points of Picnic Post NL and 700 points of Cofidis on those all-important three-year UCI rankings, which will determine which teams remain in the World Tour and which teams get relegated at the end of the year. What does that mean, 200 points, chaps? Well, that's approximately sort of 2 second places on Giro stages. 700 points to Cofidis, that would be the equivalent of, say, a fourth and a fifth place overall on the GC at the Giro. So they're getting very close indeed. It's going to be interesting to see what happens come the end of the season, isn't it? Picnic Post NL, of course, well, they're very much under threat now. Chaps mentioned a few weeks ago how the rules have changed slightly as far as entry to Grand Tours. One extra team. I understand some of these relegation-threatened teams and the teams feeling Astana's breath on their collar are not very, well, they're slightly aggrieved.
Naturally, there would be. And when you think back, Daniel, and just to put it into context, what they've done this year, I think it was 4,700 points, the deficit at the end of 2024. So they've almost closed that, you know. And there was some idiot on the Cycling Podcast Preview predicted that they'd stay up. I don't know who that was.
Who was that idiot?
I don't know. Maybe he's speaking right now.
That's not narrowing it down.
There's a few of us, aren't there? But yeah, honestly, even that particular idiot in question didn't think it would be so spectacular, the turnaround. It certainly pulled up the hands there.
I spoke a few days ago to their coach, Vasilis Anna, coach, he's now sort of head of performance, Astana, the Greek trainer, Vasilis Anastopoulos, former coach of Mark Cavendish. And he actually said to me, he sort of sounded a note of caution and said, well, we've had a great start to the season and we really, really gambled hard on the start of the season, and he was sort of suggesting that they might come into a little bit more of a difficult period, a bit more of a fallow period. That was before this weekend when they won absolutely everything, so that bodes very well. Chaps, just one other thing I wanted to mention. Brian, did you see the start of the Vuelta Femenina yesterday and Visma Lisa bike being so Delgado'd?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. The historical arriving too late for, you know, basically rolling down the ramp at the minute of the gun. No, but I saw it in the aftermath because it was a very highly debated situation, wasn't it, where they were delayed, not of their own fault.
So well, yeah, it's their fault, wasn't it? Unlike the Spanish, unlike the Spaniards to be late.
Yeah. Less of that stereotyping. Yeah,
that was. I mean, I'm very curious to see what consequences it will have.
It's a difficult one though, isn't it? Because how do you redress that? How do you correct that? It can never be as easy as just saying, well, it was Ferrand Prévot, wasn't it? And who was the second? Who was the other rider who was delayed? But Ferrand Prévot is certainly going for GC at the Vuelta Femenina. It's not as easy as just saying, well, she would have finished with the rest of the team.
That's the thing with the team time trial, because it's a shot in the dark, really. You can't really calculate that. And other than that, it's such a stressful situation because it's a domino effect, isn't it? It's not just you against the clock. It's everything that sets problems into motion.
Ferrand Prévot did finish with the team. But of course, the team lost 20 seconds to the winner. So you've straight away got a deficit on, you were looking after the first stage at the likes of Follering. And of course, Nivea Domo won the Tour. we're talking sort of 14, 13 seconds between those two riders and Ferrand-Prévot. Not the end of the world, but like you say, if it's no fault of their own and they feel aggrieved, a difficult one to deal with, because there are also rumours as well. I mean, it's difficult to, if we weren't there, I don't know exactly what happened, but there are also rumours that, you know, even though Movistar were late, then the UCI was still checking bikes before Movistar. So it's perhaps them that were late and the organisers that were late as well. So interesting to see how it comes up. The first thing I did hear was that Movistar did take a pretty hefty fine for turning up late. Mm.
If in doubt in cycling, blame the UCI.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, and this is Lionel here to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN. A little bit later this week, I'll be joining Daniel as we head to Albania for the Grande Partenza of the Giro d'Italia, and then I'll be joining him as well for a few days in Italy before I head home. And so I'm just completing my final checks for the first Grand Tour of the season. I've got my packing list all sorted. One thing I don't need to worry about is my NordVPN subscription, because that's active. I've got the app on my phone, on my laptop, and that's going to give me peace of mind when I'm logging onto the internet in hotels and the Giro press room or wherever I happen to be. I know that my data will be safe and secure. And you really want to keep all of that information secure, such as bank details, passwords, and your online identity. And when you're moving around, logging on in different places, NordVPN just gives you a layer of protection and that crucial peace of mind. It's something that's really become automatic for me because I've been a NordVPN subscriber for a long while now. It's got lots of other benefits as well, which you can find out about by going to nordvpn.com/TCP. It's a very fast VPN, the fastest in the world, they say, so no buffering or lagging while you're streaming things. And you can use one NordVPN account on up to 10 devices, so it's really versatile as well. You can get a great deal with NordVPN simply because you listen to the cycling podcast. You'll get 4 extra months on a 2-year subscription plan. There's no risk either because they have a 30-day money-back guarantee. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP and enjoy the Giro d'Italia. I'll speak to you from Albania a bit later on this week. Now back to Daniel and co for the rest of the Giro preview.
Well, chaps, as promised, we're about to talk all things Giro d'Italia. And I think I already said that I'm particularly looking forward to the start of the Giro d'Italia in Albania. Now, Albania, as well as being the host country of the Grande Partenza, is also the subject of 2 special Kilometer Zero episodes that we're releasing this week to kick off our Giro coverage, our Giro Vagando coverage. One of those Kilometer Zero episodes has already gone out. It's called Land of Eagles. And, well, I can't even really begin to explain what it's about. You just have to listen because it's a bit of an extraordinary story that I found myself a sort of protagonist of. And it ends in Albania. That's all I'll say. But you're going to hear a little bit of it in a second. That one is on our normal non-paywalled feed. The second episode is going to come out on Wednesday, and that's going to be called Big Brother. And it's a discussion with our friend, the historian John Foote, about Italo-Albanian relations over the years. Very interesting. It is too. So you're going to hear a little bit of both of those episodes right now. Late in 2024, long-mooted rumours of a 2025 Giro d'Italia Grande Partenza from Albania began to gather momentum. The first challenge of my and the Cycling Podcast annual May expedition immediately took shape. Last year, we foregrounded the Giro start in Turin with the tragic story of the Grande Torino football team and the 75th anniversary of the Superga air disaster. In 2025, I wanted to find something else, maybe a similar historical hook. And now I had my canvas. Real serendipity was also about to strike. A few days after I mentioned Carver and the Accursed Mountains on the podcast, I received a direct message on Twitter. If this in itself was surprising, it was nothing compared to what I was about to read. Dear Daniel, I'm not sure if 5.5 years after our previous conversation, people are still looking at Twitter direct messages, but it's worth a shot. Quite ridiculously, I consider myself to be still on the above ride, with whose journey through Italy you helped me all those years ago.
No, it's okay. It's a head to watch.
Oh, okay. Well, no, I'm just fascinated by your story. So, the story that you sort of summarized for me in the direct message, and yep. I'd quite like to make a whole episode about what happened to you.
But then I just started hiking and said I would be hiking. Sometimes I hike like 14 hours.
Yeah,
the night.
I found my bike thrown over the railway fence in Durham, and I like lifted over those horrible jaggedy metal things, right? Took it to the police station because it's like a beautiful Lance Armstrong era trek. Okay, this is a bit rogue.
We need sport only for show. We need sport for culture. We need sport for kids.
I would love to come. I will definitely, we'll find a way for us to meet in Tirana, and hopefully Ben Aim will be there as well.
It will be perfect. And you have also the invitation from me.
Hello, everybody. Lovely to be back on the podcast. My name's John Foot. I'm a professor of modern Italian history at the University of Bristol. And there's this probably 100 years of basically Italy kind of either invading at various times or occupying or trying kind of neo-colonial relationship with Albania. So it's a kind of long-term colony. Papers, you know, they're very glamorous. He's kind of, I don't quite understand the physical attraction. He's got a big head, glasses, big hair.
I don't know how tall he exactly is, but he reminds me a little bit of Danny DeVito in Romancing the Stone or even Twins.
A bit harsh, I would say. Yeah. He looked quite good looking when he's younger, but yeah, he turns in.
So chaps, Kilometre Zero episodes, of course, usually reserved for friends of the Cycling Podcast. If you want to become a friend of the Cycling Podcast for as little as £35 a year, head to thecyclingpodcast.com. That will give you access to around, I think it's well in excess, in fact, of over 300 special episodes. We tend to release one of these, one or more, every month. There's going to be another one coming on Monday, I believe. That's going to be the first rest day of the Giro as the peloton and indeed we make it over from Albania to Italy. We have got a very busy week because as well as those Kilometre Zeros, as well as today's episode, we're going to do some kind of episode, not sure what form it's going to take on Thursday when Lionel and I arrive in Albania. And then of course our stage coverage kicks off on Friday. Way back, last Saturday, in fact, we did our very first Giro episode, Giro Vagando episode. And that was an episode on wine, Brian. You didn't feature. You probably should have featured. That was an episode with Greg Andrews and Luciano Girotto of Divine Cellars talking about the wines of this year's Giro d'Italia. As always, we teamed up with Divine Cellars to offer a selection to showcase the terroir of the Giro d'Italia. And, well, you can find information on how to order that in the show notes. Lots to mention, chaps. We'll get to the Giro in just a second, the Giro route, I promise you. But I did also make a note to myself to mention Strava. At the Giro d'Italia, I'll be running every morning, except Mondays. I take a rest day on Mondays. And
will
I'm going to do something
really
on...
take a rest day on Mondays, Daniel? Is that...
I take rest days on Mondays generally, like a Grand Tour rider. I'm going to do something on Strava this year, some sort of weather report or some sort of kind of boots on the ground update from wherever we are, wherever we're running every day on the Giro d'Italia. It's probably going to be shambolic. I don't even know what form it's going to take, but I thought I would mention it anyway. Finally, we get to the Giro d'Italia. What number Giro is it? I haven't got that in front of me.
108.
It's 108. Rob Hatch.
Hello.
Apart from Albania, apart from Italy, where the devil is the Giro d'Italia going in 2025? Fill us in, please.
Well, we've got those first 3 days in Albania, which is the 15th foreign start, Daniel. It's the first since Hungary in 2022. It begins not strictly in the capital, Tirana, but will end the first day in Tirana. It begins in Durres, or Durazzo, as the Italians like to call it. Tirana's time trial on the second day, after a first stage that looks a little bit like the one we had in Turin last year. A final climb that tops out 11 kilometres from the finish. Van Aert, Pidcock, whoever, maybe against the world, for the first very hard-fought Maglia Rosa. Day three, already into the mountains, above 1,000 metres for the first time as well, but that big climb, the Chafa e Logarassa, the Logara Pass, that tops out 40k, just inside 40k from the finish, before a trip across, what is it, 80 kilometres across where the Adriatic and the Ionian Sea meet, and two beautiful Puglia. Expect there to be opportunities for the sprinters. Maybe you'll be listening to us talk about the beautiful Pugliese countryside, because it might be a sleepy day or two if the wind isn't blowing like it was when we were in Puglia just a couple of years ago. Remember, the fastest Giro stage, I think, of all time took place down there. It's beautiful Albero Bello, where it restarts on Tuesday after an early rest day. Then it's the shame of Italy. Matera, beautiful Matera nowadays, once denominated the shame of Italy, of course. Then up to a first contact with the mountains proper at Tagliacozzo. Castel Raimondo, we'll have seen that in Tirreno Adriatico, I think, in the last few years. That then takes place next weekend. Siena for a harder gravel stage than the one we had last year. Much harder this time, and a beautiful, beautiful monument position finish, eh? Piazza del Campo, right in the centre of Siena after the fierce Via Santa Caterina climb. Then we're connecting the walled city, home to somebody on this particular podcast, Lucca, with Pisa. Beautiful, beautiful day that'll be. And that's the second of the two time trials, by the way. 42 kilometres of time trialling in this Giro d'Italia. But they can send the time trial bikes home right at the start of the second week. They will not need them again. The middle week. We probably need to talk a bit about the middle week, don't we? There isn't too much going on paper. We've got the usual pan flat stage in Emilia-Romagna. That takes place on stage 12. Then up to Vicenza. That could be interesting, certainly, for Mr. Fribo. We're climbing from the Pianura Fribos, right up from his own plane in the Veneto, up to Monteberico, I think, in Vicenza. Nova Gorica is an interesting day culturally. In terms of the stage, we'll have to see how that works out. It goes over into Slovenia, the Slovenian side of what is Gorica, Gorizia in Italian, that frontier city that used to be the frontier of the Iron Curtain back in the day. It's a big day for Primož Roglič, who goes home to Slovenia. After that, Asiago, and then the final week. Well, it wouldn't be a Giro d'Italia final week without mountain after mountain after mountain. That's where the distance comes in as well, because this Giro is quite short on those big 200-kilometer stages, but we have a couple of them in the final week. There's disappointment for Daniel, I think, because there's no big Dolomite stage, really, no big moment where we've got those beautiful rocks, the pink rocks in the pink race, heading up into the sky. There's none of that, but we've got some important mountains nonetheless, if we can take them on. Yes, the snow is already threatening, isn't it? Colle delle Finestre, we will see towards the end of the week. A trip onto the Val d'Aosta, always an interesting one, isn't it, as well? Before finishing at Sestria with a final mountain stage on stage 20 and the dreaded long transfer to Rome, where we learned the other day we'll have a trip through the Vatican City as well on that final 21st stage.
The Giro that finishes, Rob, has its sort of concluding, probably decisive stages in a part of Italy where even, you know, with your sort of prowess in pronouncing names various countries, you could get 10 Italians in a room and every one of them would pronounce some of those place names differently. I had first-hand experience of this when I met up with Silvia, who does our jingles for the Giro d'Italia a couple of weeks ago, and we sort of spent 5 or 10 minutes racking our brains on how to pronounce some of these names in the Val d'Aosta. Even Sestriere, all sorts of variations on that. Brian, first impressions of this route, which, according to RCS Sports calculations, features 52,350 metres of climbing, which is about sort of average for a Giro d'Italia. But what stands out? We're going to get to specific stages that we like the look of in a minute, but generally, what are your thoughts?
I really like it. And it is harder than last year, but last year was also less hard than usual. There's certainly more climbing. A couple of things. There aren't that many mountaintop finishes, which there's only two, which is certainly different, but I don't think that makes it an easy Giro at all. There's some epic mountain stages with some gruesome climbs. I think there's a good sort of distribution of hard stages, including a hard-ish start and some difficult stages very early, which hopefully will give a, you might disagree with me here, but hopefully will give a dynamic GC battle relatively early. And I'm quite glad that the time trial is out of the way, I would say, halfway through. And given the, I know we're talking about favorites later, but and given the relative openness of the GC battle, at least compared to what I expect of the Tour de France, I like it. I really like it. I think we have a great possibility for and a very open race on a very hard parcours. And should anyone have a bad day in the last week, they'll be punished severely. So there could be, there could potentially be an upset as well.
One thing that stands out for me, Brian, well, you mentioned, well, we, I think we've all touched on a very interesting looking start. We'll talk in more detail about that in a minute. But I remember a year ago, Brian, I was less than enthused about the profile of the first stage. And when we actually got to those stages, we had a really great first week, partly because of Pogacar, and he was so sort of enterprising and aggressive, but not only him. There were quite a lot of finales with sort of little ramps on little climbs in the last 10 kilometers that we hadn't necessarily spotted on the profile. So it turned into a really interesting first week last week. But I think that this year's first week looks fantastic. And those first three stages, even the state of Matera could be really interesting as well. And I also see quite a lot of stages this year with climbs early on, which, okay, you know, people might look at the lack of summit finishes and say, why are such big climbs coming so early in stages? But what that tends to do, particularly thinking of riders like Wout van Aert in the field, it could lend itself to interesting breaks early on in stages. So I think that's a nice feature of this route. I also like week two. Week two last year was a bit of a, well, I mentioned that great first week, and then it was a bit anticlimactic week two. Good races in themselves are sort of one-day classics, but the general classification was sort of put on pause for a week. I don't think that would be the case this time.
Well, I think the sheer fact of the sheer outlook on the, if you look at the combination of GC contenders and the combination of quality riders who can do things like you mentioned before with Wout van Aert, but also riders like, who I don't really consider Tom Pidcock a GC rider for this Giro. He'll do a lot of things on some of those stages, and I think that could potentially also provoke some of the GC riders. And I think other riders like Mads Pedersen, you know, will try and do something on the semi-hard stages. So I think the quality and the depth of the peloton will add to that aspect that you mentioned, Daniel. So I think that I think we're in for a ride throughout the race in general. And I think because of the difficulties in the last week, I don't think any team will be able to invest fully to commit to protecting the pink jersey early on. It's simply too difficult to be able to do that.
Looking at that second week, I think I'm warming to it the more I look at it. The first, when the route was presented, I was pretty down on the second week. Of course, the time trial is going to look amazing, isn't it? It's going to be absolutely glorious. And Brian knows everything about that, given, of course, he spent a lot of time in Lucca. Pisa as well, finishing right side the Leaning Tower. Then you've got, of course...
What day of the week is that, Rob?
That is the Tuesday, isn't it? That's the first day back.
That starts... Okay, so yeah, if that's the start of the second week, then I can see why, just looking at the profile, it would possibly look a little bit, well, literally flat.
Mm. But of course, I talked about the pan flat stage in Emilia-Romagna. It's not like the other years. There's climbing in the first half of it before an expected sprint. So they have messed around a little bit. It isn't like last year's route. Nova Gorica, again, I'm undecided on that. I think with the Julian Alps up there, there could have been more interesting stage. And I'm biased because I love that part of the world. And I think it's absolutely stunning. So I like seeing those stages. We don't get a proper Julian Alps stage this year, but we do get, of course, the interesting cultural thing of going over the border into Slovenia. And I think Nova Gorica and Gorizia this year is the European capital culture as well. So that's another thing to add in there. In terms of stage to Asiago, we'll see how that one pans out. It's a long stage, isn't it, of course? And
I already told you a couple of weeks ago. I already told you in the podcast who was going to win that stage. I'm not sure if you run that week.
Marco Frigo?
No. Storichar.
Okay. No, I wasn't on that week, but there you go.
Yeah, it does have a Storichar profile, doesn't it?
It's definitely got that look about it. It's kind of similar, actually. And Brian, you mentioned lack of summit finishes. Before we started recording today, I just went through to see what were in fact the summit finishes, and I ended up sort of throwing in there a lot, well, two or three that aren't actually summit finishes, but I'm going to sort of consider them summit finishes, like Castelnuovo nei Monti, which
Sommitino,
it sort of ends on a plateau after a 5.8 kilometer climb at 5.8%. Similar with Asiago. Again, Asiago is a big plateau, really beautiful plateau, actually very rich in history, First World War history. But that is a 16 kilometer climb at 5.4%. And then a sort of, I don't know how many kilometers, is maybe 10 kilometers on the plateau. And even the stage in Val d'Aosta, Champoluc, that one, the key climb ends 20 kilometers from the finish. Same with the Sestriere stage. So bona fide summit finishes, there aren't too many.
What we do have in the last week as well that I failed to mention was an ascent of Mortirolo. Of course, there's very different sides, aren't there, up the Mortirolo. And I think we're going to have this special tribute to Contador
We're not, Rob. We got this wrong. I got this wrong last week.
I was listening to you, mate. I mean...
No, do you know what? And do you know what, Rob? I'm trying to call a gentleman who is the sort of the Mr. Fix-It of stages in that part of the world. His name is Gigi Negri. And Brian and I spoke to him last year when there was that fiasco up in Livigno when the stage start was moved.
Are we having a bet on which stage that's going to come this year?
Because this Recta Contador, which we talked about last week in the podcast, apparently work was going on to widen the road. It's sort of an old donkey track. And amid much fanfare, it was reported, although not announced by RCS. No.
But there were a lot of official media reporting it, because it did have me.
RCS ever reported it.
No, but a lot of different official media were doing. And you know what I'm like with the Giro? Normally I'm sort of, this is the one that I'm researching in October, but with the late announcement of the route, it had me looking, going, what have I missed here? Have I not seen something? And I've only just received the official road book today. So I've been looking through it as one. I've been looking for it. So I was meaning to pick your brains on that. So I'm glad we're doing it live now.
Well, when the profiles are released in usually it's the previous autumn when the route presentation takes place, then they're inexact, aren't they? I mean, in the Giro case, they're inexact until you sort of turn up on the day. But in this case, there was enough sort of ambiguity based on those initial profiles that it looked as though that could be, in fact, the ascent of the Mortirolo. Because this Recta Contador is just a little deviation off the Mono side up the Mortirolo. And sure enough, in the local press, there were reports about, I can't remember what the budget was, but tens of thousands of euros being invested. And they were very proud, the local, I can't remember the name of the village, they were very proud of the fact that this was going to be the Recta Contador and it was going to be anointed, it was going to be sort of baptized when the Giro came. However, the Garibaldi was printed last week and there is no Recta Contador. So I'm waiting for Gigi Negri to get back to me about what exactly has happened here. Anyway, that's a lot of words to say that those 3 kilometers are not going to feature.
And there's a lot of words to say as well that, I mean, this is something that I'm pretty sure that it's hard to believe for a lot of listeners. It's difficult to believe from where we're sitting as well, but a lot of the sort of typical Giro late additions to the route, you know, you can prepare a GC challenge, go and study the route, and then 10 days before, you're a sports director and you don't even know that there's this Red Bull kilometre that they've suddenly placed halfway through every stage and there's 6, 4 and 2 bonus seconds. I mean, it's pretty crazy, isn't it, that they can make changes so late? So that's why when this Contador thing came out, we all just sort of believed it, I think, because it's the typical thing that RCS would do.
Rob, what can you tell us about those kilometres? Are they in every stage?
Well, again, they're in every road stage, and I tried to do as much looking into it as I can. Again, double checking with the road book that I've received today. Because when it was first announced, I think everybody and we're all thinking, oh, it's going to be like the Benelux Tour. It's going to be like the Golden Kilometer. It isn't. It's basically a dressed up intermediate sprint for more bonus seconds. The only point that will matter, I'm sure it's going to be a branded kilometer long you know, it's very good advertising for the company in question and maybe for the team in question, because it sounds right up Primož Roglič's street, this, by the way. 6-4 and 2 bonus seconds dotted around different places in every stage. If you think back to when they brought the Inter Giro in last year, that was very late as well. They brought it back, didn't they? And it didn't quite work.
With funky rules that bore no resemblance to the original rules.
No, it was a completely... It was like, well, we'll bring it back because we want, you know, a bit of a gimmick. I think they've managed to sell that spot. This is my guess, personal guess. They've sort of sold that spot to a sponsor this year, and it's going to be an intermediate sprint, the 6-4 and 2. There are still going to be two other sprints for the Maglia Ciclamino.
Larry Warbass, who we had on last week, was not very impressed by this innovation. He was not relishing it, shall we say.
But that's the crazy thing. Again, you know, imagine you're Larry's sports director and, you know, you've been talking about this route on the training camp that they were at for a long time. Okay, this is where we're going to plan what we're going to do on this stage, if everything goes to plan, of course. And then suddenly, the whole plan can be ripped up 10 days before when everyone gets an email saying, oh, actually, we're going to have a 6-4 and 2 bonus second sprint here. But yes, to make matters simple, as far as we understand it, with the information that we have, those caveats really always must apply when we're talking about the Giro organisers. It's basically an intermediate sprint for 6-4 and 2 bonus seconds.
Which is not to be shunned at. I mean, I know it is a very, very difficult
win. I used to him Roglic. It could be the difference between a Giro win or loss, couldn't it?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, if you add those up, it could make a bigger difference than the two time trials put together.
If you think of the last, if you cast your minds back 2 years, Primož Roglič's first and to date only Giro win. Was that not the narrowest margin? Yeah, it was the narrowest margin in a long time. It was a matter of seconds. And we've seen that increasingly in Grand Tours over the last few years. Well, and how important bonus seconds are in the case of, if this race does come down to Roglič versus Ayuso, and we're going to talk about that in a minute, whether it will indeed, then those two, I would argue, are pretty well matched in terms of speed. As we saw on the last day in Catalunya, when...
We saw all week in Catalunya, didn't we?
We
really
did. Ayuso got the jersey back and then Roglič took it off him and vice versa. On it went. But chaps, I think as far as broad brushstroke sort of appraisals of the route, that's probably enough for now. Brian pointed out that really it's the riders that make the race. And we're going to talk about the riders and why the field makes this a mouth-watering Giro d'Italia. But as homework, chaps, I did ask you to pick out one particular stage or one feature of a stage you're especially looking forward to. Just in the interest of chronology, I will go first because my stage was stage one. Why? Well, mainly because of the big climb that comes after 80 kilometers. Pronunciation a little bit dicey here. It's down on the route profile as Grazen, the climb. However, the official name, it's known locally as the Chafferkrabbe, I believe. And at the top of this climb, and I don't think RCS have made anything on this, but about this, but there is a monument to the greatest Albanian cyclist of all time, Bilal Agiliu, who was born in 1935, became a sort of Fausto copy of Albanian cycling, son of a ballet dancer and a boxer, and very, very small, very diminutive chap, only 161 centimetres tall. And he won the Tour of Albania. The Tour of Albania, a very distinguished and historic race, incidentally, founded first edition in 1925, if I'm not mistaken. But Agiliu won 11 times, including 10 times consecutively. So a real legend of Albanian cycling. As I say, there's a monument to him at the top. I've been reading, it's quite difficult, as you can imagine, particularly if you don't speak Albanian, to find information about what history, Albanian cycling history, does exist and is documented. But I've been reading about Agaliu's training rides to, he used to do his favorite training ride, one of them was to a place called Chafetana, I think. I checked the pronunciation of that with the only Albanian to ride the Giro d'Italia, Egor Zupa, earlier on today. In fact, let's hear him tell me how I should pronounce it.
Allora, il nome si pronuncia Chafan.
So Agaliu would typically set off from Tirana and he would head over there to the place we've just heard Egor Zupa pronounce, on the Macedonian border. But this training ride, this route, remained a secret. Not only did he not upload these activities to Strava, he didn't tell anyone about it because he thought that this was a great sort of secret, that, that the climb on the Macedonian border was also, it tended to be one of the decisive climbs in Tour of Albania. But he thought this really gave him an edge doing these long training rides over there. And well, very successful he was too. When he retired, he became the coach of the national team. His son later became a professional footballer. He was the first Albanian to play in the Romanian first division as a footballer. But I'm guessing, maybe from you, Rob, we'll be hearing more about Bilal Agiliu over the first few days in Albania. And what an interesting stage that looks, with that Gratzen climb in the middle of the stage, but then two ascents of the Surel climb, which I believe does that top out about 12 kilometers from the finish, third category climb. And that's the launch pad that a lot of people have been talking about. Is it going to be Van Aert? Is it going to be Pedersen? Is it going to be Pidcock? Or could it even be one of the big GC boys that sees an opportunity to make inroads there? But should be very interesting indeed. Who would like to go next?
I think I'll go next because, again, we'll keep it chronological. I've gone for another of the stages in Albania. By the way, the Giro doesn't end after these stages in Albania. Don't worry about that. But they are really interesting. I think we alluded to it and we had a quick chat about the route then, that this is not just, let's tiptoe into the Giro with a few sprint stages. This is the Giro in play on Albanian soil, isn't it? Because we already go above 1,000 metres on day three, Daniel and Brian. We go from Vlora all the way back to Vlora, and it's a trip along the coast and along a mountain range that I can see already Daniel's eyes lighting up. The Ceraunian mountain range, I think it is, a coastal range in the southwest of Albania. Vlora, by the way, the third city in Albania, so it's not a small place. A lot of history there. Ancient Greeks were there. Romans were there as well. And the Bay of Vlora, the area that you'll be able to see from the top of the mountains they cross, is actually where the Ionian and the Adriatic seas meet. You can see on a very good day a long, long way across towards Puglia and towards Italy. But
or can you actually see Puglia in Italy? Do you know?
I've not been, Daniel. But I tell you what, the views on all the YouTube videos I've seen look fantastic. And this mountain range is so big, they're building a big road tunnel underneath the climb that they're going to go out, the second category climb to Chafa e Lugarassa. It's the Lugara Pass in English, really. Connects the Ducat Valley in the north with Himara in the south, and it's part of a national park there, which looks absolutely glorious. And all the videos and news reports I've seen, again, I had to watch so many news reports because, like you, Daniel, my Albanian is non-existent. I was trying to listen for the authentic way to say the names and things like that. But in terms of the Giro, there's lots of hairpins on the way up and down Chafa e Lugarassa. It goes above 1,000 metres for the first time, which on day three, pretty rare, isn't it? And again, the views on a clear day over the Adriatic must be absolutely stunning. Now, the last 20 Ks or so after the descent from the climb are flat. But again, who takes this on? It's 10.7 kilometres at 7.4%, maximum gradient at 12%. It's a serious, serious climb on day three of the Giro. And if anybody's interested, if there's a couple of teams interested, I mean, we could have three different changes of the Maglia Rosa in 3 days at the start.
Indeed. Let's hope we do. Let's hope we do. Let's hope we have a cracking start. Certainly, there is scope for that, judging by the route. Brian, I suspected that you would choose a stage in Tuscany, a climb in Tuscany in particular, and I believe you have.
I have, yes, Daniel. It's a bit of a leap. We're on to stage 11 from Viareggio to Castelnuovo nei Monti. And, I mentioned initially that there's a interesting distribution of hard stages throughout the Giro, and the big climb is halfway through the stage, and it's we tend to use the term epic a little bit too often, but I think this really is fitting here. The San Pellegrino in Alpe, the year I moved to Italy, 2001, was the first time I rode this climb, and I rode it again, I think, in 20. 2016. It doesn't say much that it's the hardest climb I've ever ridden, but it, I know that you've ridden it as well and wrote about it in was it the first or the second book you wrote about climbs?
I think it was second.
And they've done it in the Giro before, but it's a long time ago. I believe it was when Casa Grande won the stage to Abetone many years ago. It is a ridiculously hard climb. It's hard. The first part is consistently hard. And the last part is wicked hard. And when you sort of turn around the bend and then you can actually see the top, and it's just 3 kilometers to the top, but you sort of glimpse the village and you just cannot grasp that it's only 3 kilometers, but because it feels like you're looking up at an entirely different mountain. It is by far the hardest climb, I believe, in the Apennines. It is certainly the hardest climb in Tuscany. And the interesting thing here is it's actually the climb that divides Tuscany and Reggio Emilia. You actually go into Modena, to the region where Modena is, on the top of the climb. And instead of going towards Abetone, we go into different types of climbs in the Apennines. So it'll be an interesting type of stage as such, because it's so early that there will be a breakaway stage, I'm quite certain, but there will be GC action without a doubt. And it'll be a tough stage for the time limit as well, I believe, because a lot of riders will be suffering very early on here.
Brian, am I right in thinking the restaurant or rifugio at the top, half of it is in Emilia Romagna, half of it is in Tuscany?
I think it's entirely in Tuscany. Okay. Because there isn't actually what I believe used to be an old monastery, and there is a bar up there. And it actually is before the climb sort of finishes. And it's always the times I've done it, it's a great excuse for stopping early, because the climb sort of continues. And there is, in that bar, there's a very famous photo of Pantani, because he used to go there at times for training.
I mean, there's a story. So you mentioned the 2000 stage won by Casagrande, Francesco Casagrande. That stage became infamous, because it was the Giro when Pantani showed up in the Vatican. The Giro starting from the Vatican. He had been AWOL for months and months. No one even knew whether he was a bike rider anymore. And he showed up spectacularly the day before and said, "I'm riding." What a huge story. And no one really knew what kind of condition he was in. And it kind of went okay until that point. I think it was sort of end of the first week or halfway through. And it kind of went okay. And then on that stage, his direct sportif, Beppe Martinelli, took the decision that they were going to back Stefano Garzelli instead, because Pantani was struggling. And sure enough, Garzelli went on to win the Giro. But this caused a big fallout in the team, so much so that Enrico Zaina, one of the domestiques, left the Giro in a huff that night. And it was very controversial.
So the San Pellegrino and Alpe, Daniel, that you've also written about, it's in the area, the area, at least on the Tuscan side, you know, towards Viareggio. You and I did a kilometer zero about it some years ago. That is sort of the... You can almost consider it a university for bike riders. A lot of riders would come from, you know, Scandinavia, and also, you know, Nibali, who's, you know, of Sicilian origin, has also lived and trained there. This climb is considered too hard for training. Even pros who've lived there, you know, the area is called Garfagnana, and there's an abundance of long climbs and hard climbs. This, no one will ever really go there to do the San Pellegrino and Alpe, because it's so ridiculously hard.
It's really interesting as well, because a lot of people will know Tuscany, and it is in Tuscany, as we said, where it's on the border with Emilia Romagna. But when you're at the top, you really feel, I don't know about you, Brian, you know, you're more familiar with the area than me, that you just feel as though you're in the middle of absolutely nowhere. There are no real reference points. There are no big cities anywhere close. You know, you're somewhere in the environs of sort of Liguria, Emilia Romagna, Tuscany, and it feels like a bit of a wilderness. Brian, I know I've mentioned to you before, there's this legend, I've just got it in front of me, so I'll just read it out, from my chapter about San Pellegrino and Alpe in that book. There's a legend, mythology about something called the Devil's Turn or the Giro del Diavolo at the top. In local mythology, the pass has become synonymous with another scourge, the devil himself. Pellegrino is thought to have been the son of a 7th century Scottish king who renounced the throne and set out on a voyage across Europe following a divine calling all the way to the Apennine Alps. There, to be precise, a few hundred metres above the village that now bears his name, Pellegrino infuriated the devil by steadfastly resisting his temptations. As punishment, the devil struck Pellegrino so hard that he spun through 3 complete circles. The legacy of that episode was the road through San Pellegrino's unofficial name, Il Giro del Diavolo, or the Devil's Turn. So apparently, Brian, I don't know if this is true, locals still call it Il Giro del Diavolo. It also gave rise to a penitential ritual. To this day, pilgrims come to complete 3 laps of a field just east of the pass before depositing a stone representing their sins on the grass. An alternative, less popular folktale goes that it was Pellegrino who hit the devil and with such force that the latter flew back across the Circular Valley and into the mountainside. The hole he made on impact is still visible today, just below the summit of the Monte Forato, the aptly named Punctured Mountain. So, Brian, we've got a lot of sins that we need to cleanse. We'll be in that field depositing stones.
Well, we're halfway through, so there'll be a bunch of them already.
Is that where you'll be throwing all your parking tickets into that hole?
There we go.
It's a big old hole, Monte Forato. I'm very familiar with that place, actually. It's just outside Pietrasanta. Good to know.
Hello, Ned Bolting here. If you, like me, think that the journey is just as important as the destination, then can I interest you in my latest book, The Accidental Tourist? This memoir spreads its wings beyond the confines of just the Tour de France, as a quarter century of covering cycling takes me all around the world, following skinny men and women racing bikes very fast. There's chapters on life at the Giro, the growth of women's racing, and memories of Chris Froome and Mark Cavendish. The Accidental Tourist is out now and available from all good bookshops and audiobook retailers.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Well, chaps, we've talked about the canvas, the terrain. We are now going to talk about the competitors in this. What did we say? What number did we say it was?
108th Giro d'Italia.
108th Giro d'Italia. Who's riding and which teams have announced their lineup already? Are there any surprises, Rob?
A few bits of disappointment for Italian fans. No De Marchi, as we thought that, you know, he announced that this was going to be his last year and we thought that he'd be going. Gianluca Brambilla left out as well by Q36.5. Yeah, form, a lot of people would say yes, but I mean, for a team going there for the first time, he's a guy who's worn the pink jersey. There's no need Zolo either. Again, not been on the great form, has had his injury issues. But in terms of who's there and not there, I mean, it'd probably be quicker to say who's not there, because this is, you talked about an Excel preview, Daniel. It is an Excel lineup.
Before we talk about the sort of contenders particularly, just on this issue of, well, fan favourites not being selected, and what, I've made no secret of the fact that Alessandro De Marchi is one of our, we call him a friend of the podcast. He's one of the guys that, you know, we speak to most regularly at the Giro d'Italia. He's one of the most sort of eloquent and principled riders out there, one of the most enjoyable to talk to. And this is a view shared, certainly by many of our colleagues, certainly Italian colleagues. However, since it was yesterday, wasn't it, Jaco announced their team without him in it, I have seen some commentary from some of our colleagues about what an outrage this is that De Marchi hasn't been selected. I don't know if any of us, well, certainly we journalists, have enough information to be able to judge whether this is outrageous or not. Obviously, it was going to be his last Giro d'Italia. It's his last year as a pro. And sentimentally, you know, he's a guy who's worn the pink jersey. He's given a lot to Italian cycling on and off the bike. We all wanted to see him there, but these teams are not coming to just sort of ride around and pay homage to, you know, whoever's ending their career or, you know, is looking for some other kind of sentimental payback from the Giro. I don't know. Maybe I don't know whether De Marchi, I'm sure he would have been an asset to some degree, but it may be that he's been replaced by a rider. Let's not forget, Jayco Lula have ambitions with guys like Luke Plapp. It may be that he's been replaced by a rider who's more effective at positioning Plapp, who, you know, we know he finds it quite difficult at times to be in the right spot, the bottom of climbs and so on and so forth. I think it's a bit faster. And Brian, you know, I'm sure you can talk to this as well, having been a team manager, that it's very easy to make these snap judgments.
Yeah, and we don't know what he thinks about it himself either. You know, there's all kinds of reasoning behind this that we're not necessarily in full transparency of. And I'm not surprised about the Italian reaction. You know, you can write that manuscript on beforehand. But it's quite typical also for the Giro. There's so much Italian emotional equity connected to it that they will look at it as a fanfare, and they'll look at it as a last hoorah and you know, but for these teams it's everything but, you know, they, you know, and especially when you look at Plapp for you know, for him and for his ambitions, it's all about what could possibly bring him in the best position for the best possible result. And imagine if De Marchi, he himself said, well, you know what, I'm not exactly where I need to be, then he wouldn't want to let him down in that role. So there's all kinds of reasoning behind this that we're not necessarily prone to understand.
If you look on form as well, gents, I mean, you know, the riders who are in there, you can't say that their form's been any worse than De Marchi or anything like that. And as you say, there's always plans drawn up and things like that. And there's GC ambitions with Harper as well, let's not forget, as well as the stage winning ambitions. And then seeing what Luke Plapp can do with the time trials, and of course seeing how he goes in the general classification.
Well, could it be that De Marchi has maybe, well, would they be planning to bring him to the Tour?
I think that's unlikely. I think I'm hoping, my fingers are firmly crossed for Alessandro that he gets to do the Vuelta a España, where he's won three stages in the past, and that would be a very fitting send-off for him.
The one reason I think it's really touched a nerve in Italy is because he is actually the last Italian to have worn the pink jersey. That was 2021. That's 4 years with no Italian in the Maglia Rosa. That is a long, long time for the Giro d'Italia.
Well, would they want to send him there as a reminder? Sorry.
Dear me. Are you going to be let back into Italy if they're listening here? Good job you're in Schengen, isn't it, already? Dear me. But no, I think you talked about the stage when he's got the Vuelta. I think the one thing that he really wanted from his career was a Giro stage when he kept trying and trying for. So I can understand the sentiment there. The only thing that looked a little strange with me that I would say, and again, I'm not saying this in defence at the sort of strange outrage. I completely agree with you guys. People don't know what's going on in the team, and teams aren't there to be charities, are they? But there was a social media video put out a couple of weeks ago with De Marchi in it, and it didn't explicitly say that he will be riding the Giro, but...
Yeah, did we misread that?
When you put that out just before the Giro, you think, oh, hang on a minute, wow, he's retiring, they're putting this out before the Giro. Again, I'm pretty sure nobody in the team has tried to sort of pull the wool over anyone's eyes or anything like that.
Could you help me understand, though? I haven't seen that, Rob. Could you help me understand what it was?
Well, just a video of him looking through his old sort of results at the races, back on his career, nice moments in the Giro, wasn't it?
It was a sort of thank you, Brian, a sort of farewell at the end of the season. And it's interesting, I watched that and thought there was scope for people to maybe get the wrong end of the stick with that. So much so that I, as I say, very much hoped that he was going to the Giro d'Italia. So I sent him a message that day and said, look, I'm looking forward to, you know, I hope we will get to see you at the Giro. And he replied in a manner which suggested he was very confident. But I don't think it was a done deal.
Oh, that puts a different perspective into it. I definitely did not know that.
Shall we, on the topic of team news, should we have some cycling podcast team news? before we talk about the contenders.
The big reveal.
Well, it's not really that big a reveal because I've already revealed that we will be graced by the presence and the company of Lionel in Albania and a few days beyond that in Puglia as well. Then, Brian, you're going to be joining me in Napoli. And in the Veneto, in Vicenza, we are going to be joined by our new signing. Now, I mentioned the Bidon Alvento podcast. It's an Italian podcast that's been going for the last few years at the Giro. Unfortunately, the chaps will not be on the ground this year. However, we have picked up one of their... I'm not going to say... How can I put it politely? One of their most promising young podcasters.
Announce Pelacci. Yes. Announce Pelacci.
Michele Pelacci is going to be joining us. Now, you're going to get to know him much better over the course of the next 3 weeks. I think he's also going to be dropping in Albania. But I thought I'd give you a brief introduction to Michele, or that he could. He's already in Albania, and I caught up with him this morning.
Pronto.
Ciao, Daniel.
Michele Pelacci, our new signing. Here we go. Fabrizio Romano has just tweeted, here we go. Michele Pelacci to the Cycling Podcast. It's official. Michele, why? We are here to explain why I have recruited you for the Giro d'Italia. And I need to explain to myself because I'm not really entirely sure. I was told that we needed some more youth. We needed a more youthful member of our team. I was told we needed someone from Generation Z, but what we've got ourselves is a Z-lister of the Italian cycling scene, Michele Pelacci. Well, you have to introduce yourself. Who are you, Michele, and why have I recruited you?
First of all, Daniel, because I'm of the great class of 98. So it's me, Pogacar, Kylian Mbappe.
You're the youngest person I've ever met. You were not even born. Were you born, Michele, when Marco Pantani won the Giro d'Italia in 1998?
I had like 10 days
of age.
But yes, so I live in Parma, Italy, which is between Milano and Bologna. My father makes prosciutto.
We got there straight away. I was hoping you would mention that. Yeah, we've already got, Michele, and you know about this. We've got something in this Giro d'Italia, a feature dedicated to you on the days when you're going to be appearing in the podcast called the Prosciuttometro, which is going to be it's sort of the ham meter. So every day that Michele is on the podcast, he's going to have to give the stage a grade, a number out of five. How good was the stage? How many prosciutti is this stage worth? So Michele, tell us about cycling. How did you discover cycling?
Maybe the most important Italian song ever, Maledetta Primavera, di Loretta Goggi, said, per innamorarsi basta un'ora, no? It takes 1 hour to fall in love with something. And it was like that for cycling with me. And then started to go out for a 30K run, and then 50, and then 100. And then, yeah, I'm doing Gran Fondos, and I don't know, probably next year I'll be bikepacking in Kyrgyzstan or something. So
wow. Well, Michele, I mean, in all seriousness, despite the fact that I've already made fun of you and I'm slightly concerned that it's going to be about two episodes, two stages before I get reported for bullying, because that's the sort of dynamic that we have had in our relationship in the time that I've known you. In spite of that, I have to say that we have recruited you because you're an excellent young journalist. I described you as the budget Ciro Scagno Emilio, but your writing and reporting for publications like Alvento has impressed me and other people. So I'm looking forward to your journalism. On that note, I would like to know, where are you currently? And why did I say your Giro d'Italia has already begun?
Because I'm in Tirana, landed last night at 2 a.m. was a crazy flight, but I saw no signs of Giro d'Italia as of now in Tirana, which will be interesting to see how the city is embracing the Giro. Of course, Italy and Albania have a lot of history, not always great by the Italian part. I looked at the road. The roads are, I don't know.
Some, a bit sketchy.
Yay! Holes and potholes and manholes and all sort of holes around the streets.
I think we should end this call now, and we should agree that we will reconvene. You are going to be in Albania
over the next couple of days, few days. You will be there at the weekend, I believe. You're going to make an appearance on the podcast then, and then you are going to be with me in the final week in the mountains. We'll talk more about the time you've been spending in the mountains this year, covering ski racing, I'm sure, later on in the Giro. But in the meantime, behave yourself, and we will see you in just a few days.
Of course.
Ottimo. Grazie so, mille, Pelacci.
Sentiamo, dai.
Ciao, ciao.
Un po' di scoperta di Tirana. Ciao.
Sì. Ciao, ciao, ciao. So there we go. Rob, almost time to talk about contenders, but before we do, Brian, you know, Pelacci, what have you got to, what would be your word of warning to the listeners about Michele Pelacci? I'm encouraging him. I said to him before we started recording, I said, Michele, I want you to be as much of a clown in English as you are in Italian. And eventually he will get the hang of that. But I think he just needs to cast off some of his, he feels the need to be a bit serious at the moment.
When I said goodbye to him last year in Bassano, I sort of had a feeling, because I didn't know when I was going to see him next, and I gave him, first of all, I gave him a cigar, as I gave all our colleagues from Alvento a cigar, as I had some left from my own stash, and I said, "Don't forget to don't ever lose your young, joyous approach to life."
Oh God!
because, and I know that from myself, eventually it will fade. So hang on to that for as long as you can, my young friend.
In this case, it might fade pretty quickly.
Well, that's just because you'll sort of the juxtaposition to other elements in the deep end of the podcast. So yeah. I think it's a welcome element that will have his joyous self on this show.
Yeah, Wilson beat him down. Don't worry about that. Rob. Rob, who is going to win this Giro d'Italia? Who are the favourites? Who are the contenders?
Michele Pelacci, no?
No.
Right then, we've got five former winners just on the start line. One of whom we can certainly rule out of contention, I think, for the GC. That's Nairo Quintana, who won in 2014. But Richard Carapaz is there. Egan Bernal is back at the Giro, 2021 winner. Jai Hindley, of course, he won in 2022. He's a fantastic rider, but he's setting off from Albania, supporting Primož Roglič, who won this race a couple of years ago. There's also the likes of Juan Ayuso, the other big talked-up name. Simon and Adam Yates on different teams. Arensman, who was so good in the Tour of the Alps. Landismo's back as well. Mikel Landa leading Sudal Quickstep, and he's aiming for the podium again. There's a first effort at the GC for David Gaudu at the Giro d'Italia. There is Dani Martinez, of course, has been on the podium in the last couple of years, but again, rather like Hindley, setting off. I'm sure he's not going to be throwing his GC away, but setting off in support of Primož Roglič. Derek G is going to have a go at general classification for the first time. We'll see how he gets on in the GC. Not the first or the last time you'll hear that. There's Tiberi, who is back. Ciccone having to go at the general classification, see where he can get again. That might be something that changes given how he goes. Having said that, he did finish just at the gates to the top 10 in the Tour de France last year, didn't he? So he's a man who can have a go at those things. There's Michael Storer, who's been in fantastic form. Yes. Storachar, as you christened him. Sorry, that's the official name. Pale Bilbao has talked down his own GC chances this year because he might be looking at a different way of riding. But again, who's to know? He's been up there before, and if he finds himself up there in a good position, you don't throw away these things in Grand Tours, do you? Talking of Grand Tours, a final Grand Tour for Romain Bardet. He'll be trying to help Max Poole or look for his own result as well. They've been doing a lot of time and altitude in his final spring as a pro cyclist up at Tenerife. Einer Rubio's the man to lead Movistar officially, even though that Nairo Quintana is there as well. Young Davide Piganzoli, look out for him. I'm a real fan of him for Polti Visit Malta. And that probably, realistically, for the GC contenders finishes it. But again, you never know. There's likes of Harper and Plapper, who mentioned as well, for Jaco Alula too. Giulio Pellizzari, again, we imagine that he's going to be more in domestic road, but he's going to be an interesting watch as well. But for the sprinters, Caden Groves is back. Sam Bennett's back. But they're not even the headline names. We've got Van Aert, Mats Pedersen, Freitas making his debut as well. Tayson's going to be there. Van Uden's going to be there. Paul Magny is expected to be there again. I say that without having seen the official announcement yet for Sudal.
Is Olav Kooi not confirmed?
Olav Kooi should be there. Not quite confirmed yet, but should be there as well. We're still waiting for the Visma team to be given out. And one man I haven't mentioned in all of this, because I don't know where we're quite situating him yet, is, of course, Tom Pidcock.
I mean, very interesting. Very interesting. A couple of names, sprinters, Moschetti, Cantor, Hayter.
Luke Lambertia. I consider him a... I mean, not necessarily a sprinter, but someone who I think could potentially win a stage in this Giro. Would be a massive thing for him, but I consider him a huge talent.
Agree.
I put Govekar in that bracket as well for Slovenia and Bahrain. He's a fast finisher too.
Well, let's dive in, shall we, to the GC battle and what is being billed as a duel, or what has been billed by some people as a duel, Roglic versus Ayuso. First of all, is that an accurate depiction of the sort of hierarchy and the talent in this start list? Are those two a level above everyone else? Just something to conjure with. If Primoz Roglic won the Giro, he'd be clearly the oldest winner of all time. Currently, the oldest winner is Fiorenzo Magni, who is 34 years, 180 days in 1955. Primoz Roglic would be over 35 years and 6 months if he won. Of course, I referred earlier to that battle, that fascinating battle they had in Catalunya earlier this year when Roglic got the upper hand. And Ayuso, I think to say he capitulated on the last day would be a little bit unkind and unfair. But, and I said at the time in the podcast, the way in particular his team didn't really support him, I didn't think that well on that last day, didn't bode very well, because one of the question marks over Ayuso is how much of an individualist he is and whether he can rally a team, galvanize a team behind him, which he will need to do because Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe look very strong. So chaps, what do you think about these two chaps?
Well, I think the narrative is interesting in the sense that it's the age difference is so interesting, you know, Roglic will need to be at his best to win this Giro. And he's also, you know, obviously he has heaps more experience. He knows when to put pressure on Ayuso. I think Ayuso will have the upper hand on both of the time trials, but I'm not sure that's going to be make the difference at the end of the race. I think that Ayuso will eventually win a Grand Tour, but I'm not sure it's going to be this one. I agree with it's way more homogenous, the team that Roglic has behind him. It'll be interesting how... I mean, you're hearing a lot of sort of rumors that Ayuso is sort of Machin's, you know, one of the managers of UAE, is his project, and he's not really that well liked internally. He doesn't necessarily get that well along with Pogacar, which is hard to understand because he seems to get along well with everyone. So there are all these interesting dynamics. And then I've seen before when two riders have this sort of staring competition, other riders come to the fore. You know, remember the year when Roglic and Nibali were eyeing each other out? That was the year when Carapaz won. And I think because of the parcours being so intriguing this year, you know, when you have a rider like, say, even Storer or Simon Yates, Arensman, there are riders that you can't really let go or let out of sight in this type of situation. Even Ciccone, you can't really give too much of a leash. And they're not necessarily riders who will just follow those two guys. So I think I expect Ayuso will be putting in a big attack eventually, because that's not the type of racing Roglic would do. I think Roglic will wait until quite late in the race, and because they're so different in their approach to how they will win the race, I think it'll be super interesting to see. I do still see Roglic as the big favorite, though.
I would say Roglic's experience certainly puts him as the big favorite. And again, my research for the race, I was looking at Juan Ayuso's only ever won one stage race. until this year. Mm-hmm. He's now taking it on to two. He won the Giulia last year, the Tour of the Basque Country. That was his first stage race win. Of course, he's not been racing anywhere near as long as Primoz Roglic, but Roglic is an habitual winner, isn't he? He's a serial winner. When he finishes a Grand Tour, he finishes on the podium as well, invariably. Certainly in recent years since he became a GC contender, he either doesn't finish the race or he finishes on the podium, doesn't he, in Primoz Roglic? That's how he works. You saw the temperament again. I have to agree with Brian. It's the big thing with him. It comes across in his interviews. It comes across when you talk to people behind the scenes. And within the own team.
He was fourth in the world at 20, you know. It's not like he doesn't have the stamina or the engine.
He's an incredible talent. He's an incredible bike rider. I don't think there's anybody who would question that, is there? Just look to the under 23 Giro he won as well. Three stages along the way, he dominated. He was one of those, you know, one of those sort of Del Toro, Pogacar moments where you think, well, this guy's going to come along and completely dominate. And he's had a very good career so far. And he's had a very good season so far, as I used to. Yeah. He's picked up five wins, gents. And
but,
he's won,
but the pressure's on him now in a different way, right? Will he be happy? Will he settle for second? It doesn't seem to me that he has a personality that where second will be sort of, would be a good result for him. And I think that's probably one of the problems with him, really.
And then you add into the mix Adam Yates, who no one's really talking about, partly because he's had quite a low-key spring. He won the Tour of Oman and then was, well, as I said, quiet in Catalunya and Tirreno as well. But if you'd asked me at the start of the season, if you'd said to me that Adam Yates was doing the Giro d'Italia, I would have said, well, about time, because this race probably suits him on paper. It should suit him better than the Tour de France and the Vuelta a España. And he hasn't done, I think he's done the Giro once, has he? Or
2017,
long time
the only time he's done it. He finished ninth.
And same with probably
Simon, Daniel, same with Simon. And I often feel with those two guys, whenever you forget about them, you know, Simon has been very much off the boil this season. And that often bodes for them coming around very strongly.
Yeah, and Yates, we've seen in the Tour de France, particularly last year, he's become he's a model teammate. He really is. Yeah. When he's riding with Pogacar, and everything he did last year was completely selfless. When he could, and the year before as well, when he could legitimately have had personal ambitions. I mean, he did finish high up on general classification anyway. But you put him together at the stage of Yates's career, it does feel like a unique opportunity this, if he does have the form that he wanted to have going into this Giro d'Italia. And if you put him alongside a rider who is not as noticeably as obviously better or superior as Pogacar is, i.e. Ayuso, then that might create an interesting dynamic in that team. And I think there is scope for some internal politics there, which might make things really interesting. But Brian, come back to something you sort of hinted at, alluded to. I think there's a lot of scope in this Giro d'Italia for these sort of second leaders to follow a move in the guise of marking, let's just covering ourselves. Yeah, covering ourselves, but oh, look what's happened. I've gained 3 minutes, I've gained 4 minutes, I'm suddenly in the pink jersey, and we're running out of road before Rome, and I'm now the leader. It's slightly different, but you talked about the sort of inattention that day that finished on the Colle del Nivolo that allowed Carapaz to get away initially.
Exactly.
And that was, as I say, that was a sort of similar scenario, and I could see something like that happening again.
Well, when you see the architecture of the race, and when you see the stages where, you know, the stage I mentioned with San Pellegrino being on the mid stage, when you see, they're pseudo mountaintop finishes, but when you see the layout of a lot of those stages, it's not like either Roglic or Ayuso can follow every time an Ironman goes or every time Simon Yates goes. Eventually, they'll have to make up their mind. And I think that opens the door, especially for a rider like Adam. I think there's a lot of potential for those situations where they'll eventually just have to make up their mind. And in those situations, I think, I'm convinced that Roglic is the smarter rider. And I think he's a rider that has more, he can stomach those stressful situations way better than Ayuso can.
One thing I'm slightly curious to see with Roglic is that, well, I think Ayuso's talked about this in the press, and he also demonstrated this in races earlier in the year in France. He was going to be very aggressive and he was going to attack in Pogacar fashion, 50 kilometers from the finish at times. That has not been Roglic's style. However, Roglic had to go against his nature a little bit in the Vuelta, at the end of the Vuelta last year. Rob, we were there that day, the stage, the Moncalvillo, and he went further out than he ordinarily would. And I remember him sort of talking afterwards as though, well, this is kind of new for me. I had to try it. Maybe this is a bit of a blueprint for me in the future. I don't think we're going to suddenly see Primoz Roglic. He has done it occasionally in the past, but I don't think he's going to make a habit in this year of going from a long way out.
But won't he have to, Daniel? I mean, if if Ayuso, well, if I mean, Ayuso this is late goes, in the race, but if Ayuso, if he goes on Monte Grappa, and there's still 100 kilometers to the finish, he'll kind of have to follow, won't he?
Well, that's when those big climbs in the middle of stages that people have maligned and lamented. They've said, why is San Pellegrino and Alpe in the middle of the stage? Why is Monte Grappa so far from the finish? Why is the Monte Tirolo so far from the finish? That's where it could become really interesting.
Exactly.
Well, chaps, I think we should probably conclude things there. We've talked enough. We've speculated enough, something we don't usually do in Cycling Podcast. As I said earlier, we will be on our way on Thursday. There'll be some kind of episode on Thursday evening. Lionel and I landing in Albania, telling you about the lie of the land, the ambience in Tirana and Durres. We heard earlier that there was no real evidence. We heard from Michele Pellacci. There was no evidence of Giro fever yet in Tirana, but who knows? It might yet grip in the next few days. Brian, I very much look forward to linking up with you. That will be upon us very quickly, very soon, just over a week's time. And Rob, well, I wish you a very successful Giro, which I'm sure you will have.
Thank you very much. I look forward to talking to you all on Friday as well.
Thank you, chaps.
Cheers, guys.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.
The Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Wyler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.